welcome to another episode of the Came From the North, the strictly Canadian podcast where we discuss directors. This week we're focusing on an Irish filmmaker, Neil Jordan. We're missing John and Andrew, but we have Steve. Say hello, Steve.
Bonjour.
And stepping into some big shoes, and we have my friend Antoine Poulrien.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So as usual, we'll start with a short bio and a review of Jordan's filmography. Jordan was born in 1950 in County Sligo, Ireland. He was brought up by his father was a painter, and his mother was a painter and his father was a professor. Grew up a Catholic, but eventually relented the faith. He studied Irish history and English literature, and you can see those interests in his filmmaking. He wrote or co-wrote most of his movies. He started into the movie business as a script consultant on John Borman's film Excalibur, and he eventually graduated into second unit work into Excalibur. Borman, incidentally, produced Jordan's first movie called Angel and starring Stephen Ray, which is pretty hard to find. Stephen Ray would have a role in most of Jordan's films. He really came into international attention with the horror fairy tale mix from The Company of Wolves, and then went into even bigger critical acclaim with Mona Lisa, which is a kind of a crime drama starring Bob Hoskins, who would be nominated for an Oscar. And then followed with like a trio of lesser movies, all comedies. High Spirits, a fantasy film. We're No Angels, a comedy about prisoners being as priests, starring Sean Penn and Robert De Niro. And The Miracle, which I have no idea what it's about, because it never came out on DVD. and then probably his biggest, most known movie, The Crying Game, which led him to direct in the Anne Rice adaptation Interview with the Vampire, which he followed with Michael Collins, a movie about an Irish revolutionary starring Liam Neeson. After that, he made The Butcher Boy, which is about the child of the sociopath in Ireland, a kind of dark comedy, followed by the romantic movie The End of the Affair. And then another crime thriller starring Annette Bening in Dreams about a psychic who sees the crimes. And then the Jean-Pierre Melville adaptation, The Good Thief. Breakfast on Pluto, which is about the life of a transvestite during the Irish Revolution. The Jodie Foster Death Wish film, The Brave One. And fantasy movie about the mermaid called Undine. And he has a movie that's supposed to come out in 2012, which is supposed to be a fantasy thriller about vampires. He's returning to vampires again, about the mother and daughter vampire. So that could be interesting. So as usual, we'll start with our good, which is either our favorite movie or the movie that we feel is Jordan's best. To give Antoine some time to get used to it, we'll start with you, Steve.
Okay. I was torn between three on this one. My original thought right away was to go with Michael Collins. I've always been interested in that subject matter, and Liam Neeson really did, like, for an early career performance, he did a fantastic job. Then I kind of gravitated to The Brave One, again, kind of almost based entirely on Jodie Foster's performance, but then I remembered certain elements about that one, which I'll get to later on. So I wound up, I had to go with probably the most hyped film of Jordan's body of work. I had to go with Interview with a Vampire.
most hyped than Crying Game?
I think so, yeah. The Crying Game kind of, it was one of those movies that kind of came, went, and then award season came along, and everybody just started buzzing about it. You know, like it, when it was when it was originally out there, there wasn't a big deal being made about it. But I mean, every aspect of Interview with the Vampire was under the magnifying glass. You know, when they
it was hugely popular.
Yeah,
and
I mean, like
very, very much publicized.
Yeah, and it was one of those movies. Every time there was an announcement, fans went crazy. At one point, Anne Rice lost her mind on the internet over Tom Cruise being cast as Lestat. Like, she said she was going to petition and, you know, picket the theater. You know, she went absolutely ballistic.
Wow, she must have really hated Queen of the Damned then.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Probably. But on the introduction to the DVD, she said that when she actually saw the film, she relented.
Yeah. As soon as she saw dailies, apparently, as soon as she saw her first, like, dailies footage with Cruise as Lestat, she was over the moon with joy, according to her. But it was just one of those movies that, you know, for me, everything could have gone wrong. You know, like, from adapting such an acclaimed novel, and I mean, let's face it, it was, you know, I mean, I'm an Anne Rice fan, I enjoy Anne Rice's work, but nothing else she did came anywhere close to Interview with the Vampire in terms of, like, mainstream saturation, popularity. You know, it was the Twilight / Fifty Shades of Grey of the early 90s, you know? Everybody was, I mean, Oprah Winfrey was interested in this, you know, but it was one of those things that everything could have gone wrong, and I think it was perfect. You know, for an adaptation of the book, it hit all the right notes. The casting was just about perfect. And Jordan's direction, man, it was just such a stylish movie, such a beautifully rich, textured-looking movie. Lots of deep shadows, lots of earth tones and stuff, but, like, it had this really just ageless look to it. It was just such a great-looking movie. It didn't look like an early 90s flick. It didn't look like an 80s flick. You know, it just had this real timeless visual.
I think it got a lot of cues from Bram Stoker's Dracula from Coppola.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of visual style.
Definitely, yeah. And it didn't follow Coppola's theatricality so much, but definitely the visual style, there were definitely cues of Dracula there. If not quite as bleak, a little bit warmer looking than Dracula. But it was just, the first thing I remember sitting down in theater watching it, the very first thing I remember, well, the first thought was, oh my God, that's Christian Slater. But after that, it was, you know, it was, man, this is just such a beautiful looking movie. And it wasn't, you know, like Tony Scott or Ridley Scott. It wasn't this painterly, you know, this over-the-top visual style, but it just had this really warm and inviting look. And that's what kind of sucked me in. And just the performances, man, like Brad Pitt was great. Cruise was great. Banderas.
Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst in an early role. I mean, she knocked it out of the park. She did something like she did, you know, everybody rants and raves about Dakota Fanning now or whatever, you know, or a few years ago. And I say, man, go back and watch Interview with the Vampire and look at Kirsten Dunst's performance in that movie. You know, it's just so unhinged. Just really, really from top to bottom, it was just, I thought it was a great production. And I mean, I still think I sit down and watch it now. I still think it's a fantastic movie. You know, like some people call it like a campy thing or whatever. I don't understand.
I think it's pretty well directed.
Yeah.
It's got some production value that you don't see in vampire movies nowadays.
Yeah.
And the thing I find interesting is that it's probably one of the last vampire movies that really brings out the negative sides of being a vampire. It's not trying to glamorize your, make it seem cool, like in Twilight or Blade or anything like that.
Yeah, and they play the angst, like I mean, you know, Twilight with what's his face, Sparkly McSparkly Pants.
Robert Pattinson.
But you know, and I don't want to knock Pattinson as an actor because I can't judge him based on the Twilight movies alone. But you know, like just the way they treat the vampires as these tortured souls and stuff. But they play it so heavily, whereas Interview with the Vampire, that balance was there. You know, like, yes, these guys were tortured, but they gave you reason to believe that these guys were tortured. You know, they really kind of, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, Brad Pitt's anguish is very much a deep-seated anguish.
Yeah,
I mean,
and it's tangible anguish. You know, you can see why he's so pissed off and so bitter, you know.
And that whole thing about, like, both characters doing the whole, I'm going to leave you with a choice I never had, die or live forever, that's pretty good, too.
Yep, and just, you know.
You can understand why the characters on the spot, they choose that they want to live, but in the long run, maybe they regret it.
Exactly.
Well, not Lestat, I say. Lestat revels in it.
I'm sorry?
Lestat, he revels in it. You know, he loves being the vampire, the king, the flamboyant child, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's the thing that's interesting too about the interview, which is that it's from Lewis' point of view. And I think that's what made the success of the novel, that novel in particular, because then Rice was mostly focused on Lestat. And I mean, he's an extraordinary character, but you don't have like this human touch that Louis brings.
Yeah.
To the story.
And the last thing for me with it, I got to give Cruise all the props in the world. You know, he was just fantastic in that movie. He really Tom Cruise.
We forget it from time to time. Tom Cruise is actually a pretty good actor. Like, he can pull off some pretty difficult roles and make us, you know, identify with him, even without all the Scientology hijinks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the guy is, you know, I mean, we've gotten into our thoughts on Cruise before, and I think the guy is an especially honest human being who just wants to help people, and, you know, whatever his religious choices or philosophical choices, they're done with all the earnestness, you know, like, it's not done to be weird or obtuse or difficult. He wants to help people. He just genuinely is a benevolent guy, and it sucks that people can't see past the personal life to judge his performances accordingly, but you know that should silence any doubters. I mean, Interview with the Vampire, and to an extent, you know, Valkyrie or The Last Samurai. But guys, just watch these movies. Born on the 4th of July, and the guy's an amazing actor. And I don't know why people had so many doubts, even going into Interview with the Vampire, that he could pull it off.
Well, it's because he's a bit of a pretty boy, too, and people have a difficulty accepting that someone can be really, really handsome and a good actor at the same time. Like, Leonardo DiCaprio had this issue when Titanic came out and all the girls started, fantasizing about him. Well, people loved his talents as an actor, but DiCaprio was a pretty good actor as well.
And even Brad Pitt's another one. You know, I mean, I remember 7 Years in Tibet, when that was released, everybody's like, oh, look, pretty boy Brad Pitt's doing a serious movie, and it's... You know, Pitt's actually a decent actor.
Oh, yeah, he's amazing.
I know my wife wanted, like, Roger Howard to play like that. That would still be interesting.
Really, really cool.
Well, didn't she say originally the character was kind of a combination of Roy Batty and Sting?
Yeah. it's really a great movie that really draws you into its world. I mean, the recreation of the time has been painstakingly difficult. You know, you really feel that you're living there in the 18-whatevers. And the costumes, everything, you know, is top-notch. The music... Elliot Goldenthal's music is some of his finest work, I think.
Yep.
And I almost want to choose it as my good two, because I'm really like a huge genre fan. I'm one of those people that almost regrets that Banderas was cast as our mom, because in the books he's also a kid. He's like 14, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But he was so good in it.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. So what about you, Antoine? What did you take as your good?
My good would be Mona Lisa. I really, really enjoyed that movie. I thought the mystery, the intrigue, the whole London prostitution underworld, I thought that was really, really well made and really interesting. The casting again was really, really good. I love Bob Hoskins. I mean, I usually really like him as an actor, but he usually plays these secondary, really hateable and evil characters. And in that movie, he's kind of playing the same role, but in some way, he can carry the film, and you sympathize with him. You see an evolution in his character. I really, really love that.
Actually, like, before being known in America, Hoskins was kind typecast as that kind of low-end gangster. He also played in a really good movie called The Long Good Friday.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent movie.
And, yeah, and I thought the mystery was really good. Michael Caine as the crime lord was really, really intense. It's good to see Michael Caine in those older roles where he's really badass and it's really fun.
Yeah, Mona Lisa also evokes a special kind of feeling and atmosphere. And I think that's Jordan Stalin for most of the part. He really brings an interesting eye, and he attacks most of his movies thinking about how we can make this interesting and how he can bring the special feeling of the script that he's attached to.
Mona Lisa is the one. Hoskins is the driver in Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah, he's the driver.
Yeah, that was a great movie.
Did you forget about that?
I totally forgot. I'm looking at Neil Jordan's Wikipedia page here now, and I'm like just clicking through, and I'm like, crap. It's that movie by that guy.
That's the thing that's hello?
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. I mean, his work is so diverse that often people forget that he's done a particular flick, and he devotes himself so totally to the movie that, I mean, he does have a distinctive visual style, but it's not something, you know, as evident as someone like Stanley Kubrick, let's say, you know?
No, definitely not. But I think that every one of his movies has a distinct visual style. And for me, that one was like really, really dark and almost neon lit. That's the feeling I have about the movie when I think about it, like for most of it. And I thought it had a really, really interesting look. And the characters were really amazing and well-written, too. One thing I would say about Neil Jordan is that I have a hard time relating to his characters most of the time, but in that movie, I thought that, like, I felt for the guy. I felt for Bob Hoskins, like, at the end when he goes to see the prostitute, and he's like, okay, so I helped you now. So he brings her flowers, and he's like, okay, we're going to get married now because we're in love and all that stuff, and you see on her face that she doesn't respond to it, and it's so heartbreaking to watch. It's amazing.
Hoskins has really like a great sad puppy face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And the music is also interesting in that movie. In most of his movies, the music is really well used.
Yeah, I've noticed that in most of his movies, the title of the movie is actually the name of a song that's featured in the movie. I don't know if that's intentional, but that's the case for Mona Lisa as well.
For my good, I also had to choose between three. My choices would have been Interview with the Vampire, The Company of Wolves, or The Butcher Boy, and ultimately I have to go with the Butcher Boy. Anyone who knows, who listens to this podcast, knows that I like films, the weird stuff. I usually go for the weirder stuff, and The Butcher Boy is definitely weird. But it's a very interesting movie. It's both very funny and very dark.
Very disturbing.
Very disturbing. The main character is fascinating. I mean, he's got this extremely charismatic personality. And at the first, you don't think that this will go the places where it goes. You can see that he's a little bit unhinged, but you don't think he'll go that far. But, I mean, the casting is...
Oh, the actor, oh my God, he's so amazing. It's hard to choose really good child actors, and that guy is amazing.
And, again, I mean, just the time recreation, you feel that really in that time and place. And just the whole, you know, how he handles the varying tones. I mean, everything's well handled, you know. Some of these, this is another movie that could have been a total mess, you know, done by someone else. But Jordan realizes the kind of movie that he's making, and he handles all the shifting tones very, very well in this film.
I really like the sort of end of the world theme that was going on in the movie. Like, everybody thought that the nuclear bomb would explode, so everyone thought that the end of the world was coming, and he was having these fantasies about nuclear bombs and people running into flies and stuff. So I thought that was really, really well made. Well,
wasn't it tied into the Bay of Pigs invasion or something?
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I think it's earlier than that, though.
Yeah, probably.
It could be. I'm just going on vague memory here now.
I think it's more like 1950s than 1960s.
Okay, I thought it was a 60s thing.
And yeah, I mean, Stephen Ray plays the father, and he's also very, very good, showing that he's both a loving father and an unforgivable drunk who beats on his kid. And you can see how his environment messed that kid up. I mean, his mother is crazy.
He also plays grown-up Francie, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And I think he also provides the narration.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Stephen Ray is in a lot of Neil Jordan movies. How do you feel about him?
I think he's very good. I think he's a very interesting actor. He's got this kind of, everyman face.
Yeah. He sort of underplays all his roles. He's very minimalist in his acting.
Except when he's in Underworld movies.
Is he?
He's in the last one, yeah.
Oh.
It's late 1950s for The Butcher Boy.
Oh, okay, right on.
It's won the Silver Berlin Bear for Best Director at the Berlin Film Festival, and the young actor got a special mention.
Excellent.
What is he doing now? Is he still making movies?
I have no idea.
Not really. Well, he's making 4 movies. That, The Magdalene Sisters, and 2 other movies that I don't know. So he's barely acting right now. Which is a shame, because if at that age he was that good, I would like to see him in more stuff.
And it almost makes me I'd link it with Cronenberg's Spider in a way. It's got that interest in abnormal psychology and the sources of that psychology.
Yeah, except it's like reversed, right? Because he's all sick and he's trying to find out, like, where it came from, and in that case, it's like the opposite.
So
O'Connor as the Virgin Mary was funny too.
Yeah, that was a great choice.
It was one of those movies for me that I did enjoy it, but it was one of those ones. It's like I know we said the same thing about Crash when we did Cronenberg. You know, it's one of those movies that I watched it, I processed it, and I came to the conclusion that I will never ever watch it again.
That's so good.
And I don't mean that in a harsh fashion. I don't mean that in like a negative connotation. Just it made me very uncomfortable.
Well, that's what it's wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. And it could have been, you know, it could have been so ABC movie of the week, you know, it could have been so weekday afternoon special. You know, it could have, you know, the drunk dad, the crazy mom, watching all the TV and the comic books. He could have gone down such a traditional path with that, and it just would have been such a terrible movie, but he didn't. And I got to applaud it for that.
He adapted it from the novel with some help of the author of the novel. So, I mean, it's got that literary origin, and so, I mean, it's it's got a pretty solid base, I think.
For sure.
But it's also very, very cinematic. I find the cinematography is really, really interesting. I thought that the look of the movie was very, very, the colors were all mute, and it went with the whole atmosphere of depression and people on the edge of panic because of the upcoming war that might happen and all that stuff. So that was nice too.
I feel a bit as if like the visual style is borrowed from a bit from German German films right after Expressionism, where they were still influenced by the Expressionism, but weren't totally in that style. So a lot of like Dutch angles and like the sweeping camera moves and the tight corridors and all that stuff.
Yeah, it definitely had a what's the word? An esoteric visual style. You know, like it wasn't. Wasn't a textbook
well
film.
it's intent. It's subject. You know, that's why it's my good. I mean, as you said, Steve, this is a movie that could have been gone horribly wrong, and everything is done perfectly to fit that story that it's telling. And I find it, even though it's disturbing, I've seen it 3 times by now, and I still find it hugely entertaining. Mostly because that character is actually pretty fun. So he's so funny.
You're a sick man. You're a sick man. Didn't we say this exact? Mm-hmm. Like, didn't I utter that exact phrase during the Cronenberg podcast?
Highly possible.
And I'd like to talk about the use of the narration in the movie, too. I thought it was interesting that, you know, the character talked back and forth with the narrator. And I think that it must have been one of the first times it's been done, right? I know it was done in Fight Club later and other movies as well.
I'd say it could have been, for sure.
Yeah. It's a highly unusual approach.
And not really typical of Jordan's work either.
No. There's not much narration in any of his films. But
no, exactly. The look of that movie was very very modern compared to his other movies. It almost felt like Trainspotting or something like that.
Well, I feel that that thing brings you more into the mindset of the movie, to have the narration and to have him talking to himself. I mean, you're really in his mindset, you know, you feel that you're trapped in the sick mind.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll move on to our bad. Once again, to precise, bad is not necessarily a movie that we hate, but a movie that we find is good, but has too many flaws to be our good. So let's start with you this time, Antoine.
Okay, my bad is actually the Crane game. And I'm going to explain it because I genuinely think that it's a good movie, but I think that it maybe relies too much on the little twist at the end. And without that, the movie, to me, wouldn't be really that interesting. And I should we spoil the twist for those who don't know? Or?
I think there is a statute of limitations.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I think everybody knows it by now.
Well, no, actually, I watched the movie for the first time last week, right? And I didn't know. Like, I was so shocked when I saw the dick because I didn't expect it at all. And I thought, like, the movie started off with the whole Forrest Whitaker thing, and it was a hostage situation in which the hostage was taking, like, power over the actor, basically. And I thought the whole movie was going to be in that scenario, and I really didn't like Forrest Whitaker's character. He was a bit of a smartass, and he was trying to play the guy. And I thought his performance was kind of pretentious, and I really didn't like that part, personally. But as soon as it took off, everything about it was the character acted so weird in that movie. Like, why would Stephen Rea's character become so obsessed with the guy he had something to do with before that he would track down his ex-girlfriend and immediately fall in love with her? That, to me, did not make sense at all. And apart from that, I mean, the whole romance between the two characters, I thought was not believable at all. I mean, I thought that every character acted in a way that which was completely unrealistic. But what was interesting about the movie, though, I thought that once the twist arrived, once we found out that the girl was actually a guy, I thought that posed a really, really interesting scenario for the character, because like, it really makes you ask yourself, like, if you really, really fell in love with someone, not just like a little crush, but if you really fell in love with someone and found out that it was a dude and you're normally attracted to girls, then would you consider considering that person, you know? but for Stephen Reed's character, it's very black and white, you know? It's like, oh, he sees the talk and he's like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm doing the rest out of pure duty. And he says that. He says, like, it's in my character. I help people, and that's what I do. So I'm going to go through with it and help her as much as I can, you know? But I thought it was a flawed movie. And at the end of the day, most of the movie I did not like, but the last quarter of the movie, I'd say, was really, really interesting.
Well, I think that's probably the main problem with that movie is it doesn't really know what it wants to be. It tries to tackle all this different stuff, but is not really sure what its focus is.
Still there?
Gabe?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Everything just went really quiet.
Okay. So I was saying that you can guess, kind of guess, because, I mean, she insists on only, like, giving him blowjobs and him not seeing her naked or not having sex. It's kind of like she comes up with all these excuses, you know, that nobody would accept normally.
I can dig
it. Yeah, but at that time, it hadn't really done that kind of a twist. I mean, there was, like, yeah, Sleepaway Camp, which did pretty much the same. It's not a twist that you expect from a movie of that period, I think. I think now people always expect a twist, but when you're watching a straightforward movie and you're not expecting it to go that way, it's kind of still surprising. But now it's different.
And I think that's mainly that's why it came to so much attention and publicity. I think even won the Oscar for screenplay, which is ridiculous because that screenplay is a mess.
It did win the Oscar, actually.
But like, ooh, a twist we didn't expect. Let's give it awards. Let's give awards to The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, the Oscars are bullshit.
Well,
let's just say it's recording. Podcast. The whole world could hear it. The Oscars are bullshit. And the only ceremony that I still respect personally is Cannes, basically.
I, you know, they have their place. That's the way I look at it, but
yeah,
I'm just indifferent. I'm ambivalent to all of it.
I just follow it from a pure, like, completist standpoint where I have to know, you know, what one and other and stuff, just to be able to bitch about it.
Titanic, are you shitting me?
So I think that pretty much covers the crying game. I find that for the most part, it's not that interesting of a movie outside of the twist. So what about you, Steve? What did you choose for your bad?
This one, I really, really like this movie. I actually probably I may even like it a little more than my good, but I picked the brave one. There's something about that movie. It's, you know, Jodie Foster is amazing in it, and just the idea, you know, it's Death Wish. It's a straight remake of Death Wish, and I mean, you don't see, you know, based upon Death Wish or anything like this in there anywhere, but it is the Paul Kiersey story all over again, you know. But it really kind of, it settles it down in a more, like, down-to-earth, believable environment, and it really gets more into the psychology of her transformation, about why she does what she does. And on top of that, you know, like with Death Wish, it was like in the blink of an eye, all of a sudden Kiersey's a hardened killer. Whereas in The Brave One, you know, she fights with it. She struggles with it. She doesn't really entirely know what's going on. Erica is kind of this, like, she's tortured by the violence, you know, like she doesn't latch onto it. And it's done, like, Foster, again, she nails it. She really portrays it so well. Howard is a great character. The Detective Mercer, I think his last name was. And it's just like, it really captured that, like, New York was a character, you know, as cliche as it sounds, New York was an extra character in this movie. But the ending, and I'm going to spoil it. I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to throw a total spoiler alert. The ending for me flushes the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
She should not have gotten away with it. And Howard's turn was completely unrealistic. After
an
amazing scene in the bar or the coffee shop where he's sitting at the bar talking to her and he says, you know, were someone to be doing this, I'd bring him down. And, you know, he's cold, he's determined, and he's letting her know, like, I know what you're doing, it's on. And then in the ending, it's just, you know, here, shoot me in the arm, take my gun, get out of here, I'll take the fall. You know, it's just like, what? whoa, slow down. You know, wait, what just happened? The movie just completely shits its pants in that final scene, and it's, you can entirely tell that it was either an agent dictated or a Jodie Foster dictated or a studio dictated change that was made, because there was no way in hell the studio could have Jodie Foster take the fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that just aggravates me so much, because for the rest of the film, she was really given it. She was really so into it. And then just to throw that ending in there, I think it not only does a disservice to the film, but it does a disservice to Jodie Foster as an actress as well. You know?
I'd agree. But another problem I have with it is that it's a problem that we saw with Blue Steel. And, I mean, why does she, like, befriend the cop that's on her case? I mean, to me, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think it's more of a, he's the link to her old life, because he's also the guy investigating, like, what happened with her and her boyfriend, right? So he's kind of he's her last link to him, to her, mm-hmm. her dead fiancé, you know? So it's kind of, it's a situation where she still associates with him because that's her old life. You know, that's who she was as a person. And, I mean, she's becoming this, you know, for lack of a better word, this psychopath or this sociopath, but she's clinging to the old way. And I think that's why she still talks to Howard. That's why she's still his friend, because she thinks, like, in her mind, her thought process is not, she's not in that headspace. She's not in the vigilante killer headspace. She's in the violence is still shocking her. She's not really sure how to deal with it. And talking to Terrence Howard and, you know, that little bit of denial on her own part, like, I'm not the person doing all this. You know, I'm just having a chat with my cop friend, you know, who's still investigating what happened to my boyfriend, you know, that kind of thing. So it was more of a, I think in that situation, like, I bought into it that way because that was how it had felt to me. Like, Foster didn't really feel like she was, like, it wasn't intentional, you know?
Mm-hmm. And also, one thing I found interesting is except for one guy, like the scumbag who's on trial.
Yeah.
the people she kills either attack her or try to profit from her or stuff. So she's only reacting to violence that she sees happening or that is caused to her. She doesn't
actually.
She doesn't become a crime fighter except for that.
No, she's not Batman.
Yeah. Except for that scumbag, and that's only because Howard told her about him.
Yeah. And I think that was almost kind of, you know, that's what sets her up as such. But, you know, and that's the thing. She's a reactionary character. She's not, and I mean, yeah, Kiersey kind of is initially as well. You know, he gets on the subway kind of almost identical. But his whole thing is he's putting out a flag, you know?
Yeah.
And she's kind of doing the same thing, I think, but it's more to test herself than to test them, you know? It's a really, I think psychologically and like just for how it's put together, I think it's a really cool movie. But I just think that ending ruins it.
Yeah, it's the old Hollywood aspect of it that ruins it. Because it could be a really great film.
Yeah.
But you're right. That ending totally kills it.
I mean, the first time I saw it when I was sat down watching it, and that scene, you know, where she knocks on the guy's door and, what do you want? I want my dog back, you son of a bitch. I was like, yeah! Yeah!
And you can recognize Jordan's visual style, even though it's outside of his usual interest.
Oh, it's still there 100%, yeah.
Yeah. For my bad, I'm going with High Spirits, which is a fantasy comedy starring Peter O'Toole and Steve Guttenberg and other sort of folks. The basic concept is pretty interesting, and I think the beginning of the movie, like maybe like the first half, works pretty well. It's about this guy who was a haunted castle who's falling into disrepair, and he decides to create false ghosts to bring tourists to his trap. And when the false ghosts fail, real ghosts start disappearing, and that's where it transits into bad. Because then the movie only focuses like on the ghosts and a stupid love story where they're like Steve Guttenberg falls for Daryl Anna's ghost. And because of their love, she'll become flesh and ridiculous. but for the most part, the fighting is fun, and again, visual style is pretty good. And one of the major failings is that it has too many characters, and it only focuses on like Steve Guttenberg and his wife, and you don't really get that much of the action from the other characters. I mean, you could see compared to something like Murder by Death, you know? It's a totally different picture, but it has a lot of characters, but each of the characters gets their moment, and you don't really have that in High Spirit. But still, I mean, I enjoy it for, like, being an ersatz of something that Tim Burton in his old days could maybe have done.
I guess, you know, it kind of has almost like a Beetlejuice-ish quality to it.
Yeah, with the wedding and stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely not too much of a stretch. Not quite as visually inventive.
No. I mean, for the most part, Jordan's visual style is kind of pared down in this one. He's not doing some crazy stuff that he usually does.
Yeah.
But as I said in my intro, we had like this string of three pictures where like he was trying his hand at comedy and finding out that comedy doesn't fit him at all. I could fill it in with We're No Angels, which is this. It's silly, but it's still enjoyable. I mean, the hero and Sean Penn were usually really bad in comedies that actually aren't as bad as this one. Sure, they're mugging, but that's part of the idea, is that they're over the top. But it's not a very interesting movie to talk about. It's mostly mediocre.
I haven't seen it, actually, so I can't really comment.
Although there's some interesting Catholic stuff going there for Jordan, so maybe that's what appealed to him. Because there's the question of like miracles and stuff.
I'm a We're No Angels. Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, but it's still not my ugliest worst. So let's move on to our ugly. What's your choice, Steve?
We're No Angels. I just saw the cover or the theatrical poster for it or whatever. It's like, oh, that piece of shit. That was the first thing that popped in my head. It was just, oh God. I confuse bits from We're No Angels with bits from that really bad Ben Stiller and Edward Norton movie where one was a rabbi and the other was a Catholic priest.
Keeping the faith.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, that piece of crap. Yeah.
Yeah, that was directed by Norton.
It was, yes, yeah, yeah. I think that was why
and
I watched it.
Where No Angels is written by David Mamet, so it has some potential, but...
No, it just... Oh. I pretty much, you know, it didn't know if it wanted to be a drama, it didn't know if it wanted to be a comedy, it was just... It was a mess of a movie.
Oh, yeah, totally. The Sean Penn, like, turning into this good guy. He's, like, the dumbest of the dumbest characters. they're all pretty dumb in this movie, but Sean Penn's the dumbest one.
Yeah.
He becomes, like, this inspiration for John C. Reilly, and he makes, like, this big speech when he at the lottery, and everyone applauds him. It's ridiculous.
And they got to the little deaf mute kid, and it's bad. It's just so bad.
For some weird reason, I still kind of enjoyed it. I saw it as a screwball comedy, and I kind of enjoyed it as that matter. But yeah, it's not really good.
I just, you know, it to me, it's. If it worked as a screwball comedy, even, you know, like, I mean, I'm not a hard guy to please. I mean, I love Hal Needham, okay? Bring it on. Cannonball Run, I love that too. But, you know, it was just, this one was just so, like, the humor, and I guess what it is you had Robert De Niro and Sean Penn at the height of their taking themselves seriously phase trying to do comedy, you know? To me, it just felt so flat.
Sean Penn brought like a kind of Jeff Spicoli batch for that role.
I could see, like, you know, every time Jordan said cut, I could see them standing there trying to get into the motivation of their character and trying to deep and discover their method. You know, De Niro sitting there like, no, I need to get into the headspace of my character, and I need to, you know, like, oh.
And a character that has no headspace to speak of.
Because there's just nothing there. And yeah. It was surprisingly, like, I mean, like you say that it was written by David Mamet, and I'm just kind of like, man, it's not very lyrical for a Mamet story.
No, I feel as though there were probably some rewrites, because you don't hear any of the usual Mamet dialogue.
Yeah, there's no F-bombs. One. No, there might have been. I can't really remember entirely, but
it says it was PG-13, so it might have been cut down.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, and you see, I think you see the more boobs, so that probably earned it the PG-13.
Oh, it was no, no.
it's a pretty bad thing. I think the most interesting thing about it is the beginning, which is like in a prison that seems to come from hell.
Again, yeah.
It's like this industrial nightmare place.
It was,
and that's the only that feels Neil Jordan-ish, basically.
Then let's all go to Canada.
Oh, yeah, that's also ridiculous. I mean, the main motivation is trying to cross into Canada. They're having all the difficulty crossing the border, and they just keep on trying. The more I think about it, I think the more I'm disliking it.
Yeah, and it also, as well as Sean in the movie that wasn't The Princess Bride, so it's not worth watching for that reason either. Yeah, so there's my choice. We're No Angels.
And again, I have to bring the Demi Moore hate.
the table.
I forgot about Demi Moore. She didn't have a shaved head.
But it's not. I think it's worse than G.I. Jane, though.
Yeah, definitely. what about you? I'm not your ugly.
Okay. My ugly. I said some of the things about it earlier, and I was honest, but overall, I really, really hated that movie, and it's The Butcher Boy.
Damn you!
I know, like, it's supposed to be that it's this great movie, and I really tried to like it. Like, you know, we talked earlier about Neil Jordan's humor in We're No Angels or High Spirits that doesn't quite work, and for me, that's how I felt watching The Butcher Boy. It was just a series of jokes, like dark humor, that I really, really didn't find funny. And as you said earlier, Gabe, the whole movie puts you in the mind of that little boy. And I hated the brat. I hated him so much. I could not relate to any of his decisions. And the whole narration was read by the adult him, played by Stephen Rea. His mind process was that of a little boy. So the whole movie was geared into putting you in the shoes of that crazy little boy. And I just couldn't relate to him. And I found the experience very, very annoying. And I kept pressing the display button on my DVD player, wishing for it to end. I thought it was an atrocious experience. For me, I hated every minute, and I wish I liked it, but I really hated it. I thought that it was trying to find, what pissed me off is that it was trying to find a link between the upbringing of the kid and how he turned out as an adult, and I thought the answer was a little too simple. It was trying to say, oh, if you have, like, bad parents, and you live in a crappy neighborhood, your teachers are mean to you, then you're going to become a serial killer, you know.
And you watch bad TV and you read comic books.
But yeah, exactly. I was preachy.
You can see, I would disagree, because you can kind of see it from the beginning that this kid is messed up, you know. I mean, he keeps referring to himself as the incredible Francis Brady. I mean, it would be crazy anyways, and like his mother's crazy, so the genetic part of it, and I think maybe what it's trying to say, I don't think it's trying to pass a message.
You don't think it's trying to put a message?
No, I don't think so.
Just trying to tell a story, you think?
Yeah.
I'm kind of in the middle on that thought. I'm kind of, you know, like, I don't think it's quite as preachy as all that, but I definitely think there are a few moments that feel a little ham-fisted.
But that's, yeah. It's a bit the problem when you run into that stuff. I mean, you could maybe say the same thing about Spider, because, like, the whole background is also, like, very Freudian, and, like, father who's going out, and he doesn't have a real father in anything. It's a problem when you're translating psychology to film, which is not always easy to do.
And that's true. That is true.
Then don't try to do it then.
Well, I think it's better to try, you know, and make it beautifully. I mean, as much as you didn't like the movie, you can't argue that it was really well made.
Yeah, no, exactly. As I said before, I thought the cinematography was there was really, really great. I liked some of the ideas. I liked the whole end of the world thing, as I said. It was pretty good, and the acting was amazing. But I just thought it didn't come together as well as some other movies that I think were trying to achieve the same goals, like Clockwork Orange or Trainspotting, or, you know, movies that are trying to put you into the head of someone that's socially excluded in some way.
I can understand that train of thought. I
definitely
can. Yeah. I don't entirely agree with it, but I can understand how you could think that way about it.
I think it's one of those movies that either you get it or you don't. But
No, I mean, there's no middle ground.
He just told you you're wrong. you just don't get it. You ain't hip enough.
No, I mean, that's not what I meant. For my ugly, I'm going with In Dreams, which I'd liken to something like The Lovely Bones. It's trying to tell this, like, fairly pedestrian mystery story and putting way too much artistry in it for its own good. And everybody's playing over the top. I mean, like, there's not a single good performance in this movie. And admitting, I remember hating it, and I tried rewatching it. I couldn't get, like, further than 20 minutes of it into it, because then admitting was just grating my nerves. and her husband is really bad. It's the kind of terrible movie that only a good director can make. Because it's really like a really cliche story where like this woman is having premonitions of the crimes, and she's trying to tell the police that like she's seeing these things happening, but they won't listen to her, so she has to go on the case. And of course, the serial killer is a cross-dresser. Of course.
Robert Downey Jr.
I'm surprised the IRA wasn't involved at all.
And even he's terrible in that movie.
I read it was the last movie he made before he went into rehab, so that might explain it.
But, yeah, it's just so over the top, and it's trying to take itself seriously, and it's just ridiculous. It's like, I don't know if you remember the movie Blink. I think with Madeline Stowe, where she was blind and she like kind of saw the killer.
Yes, yeah, I do.
No, I don't.
It's kind of that like this movie, but worse. I think The Lovely Bones person is apt. I totally hated The Lovely Bones.
Oh, I love The Lovely Bones, actually. But it wasn't trying to be the same thing. Like, this is really trying to be a murder mystery, whereas The Lovely Bones focuses more on the spiritual side of the afterworld or whatever.
With boring platitudes, but...
I actually...
Well, we're not doing a pizza.
I actually kind of liked In Dreams.
You're bad.
It was fine. Like I thought it was okay. It just wasn't a great movie.
I thought it was really atmospheric, like really creepy, and it was one of the few, I guess, like horror thriller or whatever you want to call it. It was one of the few films that had scenes that I actually found were genuinely spooky. Like, normally horror movies and stuff like that don't do anything for me, like all these ones that rely on shock kills and stuff like that. Like, it's, to me, it's boring. But In Dreams had a few scenes that really kind of unnerved me, that really kind of unsettled me.
There are a few nice moments, but I think overall it's a failure.
I think it never comes together. I mean,
yeah.
The final act is a total clusterfuck, but... You know, I had to get at least one in there. But yeah, no, it's, you know, it never comes together, but there's so much of it that I did enjoy. And it was actually one of the first movies that my then girlfriend, my now wife, actually saw together. And we both, like, we came out of the theater and we both said, you know what, I really enjoyed that. You know, like, we both did have a good time with it, but it's not something I've seen in... I know we bought it on DVD the first year we had our DVD player, but it's not something I've seen much since then. I might have watched it once or twice in the last 10 years. So, you know.
But it's like the dream sequences are interesting, of course, and like it's beautifully shot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, as I said, it's trying to put too much artistry into a story that doesn't really need that approach. Or command it, you know?
It doesn't really warrant it.
Yeah. So that's why it's my ugly. Like I said, I couldn't get in with a dog a little time. I was like, when Ben sees that her daughter is gone and she starts screaming, I feel.
But it's so bad because Annette Bening is a great actress when she gets in the movies, but she chooses really bad ones.
But even in really good movies, I couldn't stand her. In, like, she was the only thing I did in like an Open Range.
Oh.
But it's the only thing, Steve. I love that movie.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
You don't, she's too we're not doing custom, but she's too modern for Open Range.
You don't name drop Open Range in a negative connotation and not expect me to react to it.
I probably love that movie as much as you do. I think it's Costner's best work, but we're not doing Costner.
It's also amazing.
I haven't seen Open Range, so I'll check it out.
It's an amazing showpiece for surround sound.
Amazing.
When I really want to blow people away with my sound system, it's either that or Master and Commander.
What one of the best shootouts ever filmed?
Oh yeah, for sure.
In Master and Commander or Open Range?
Okay. Well, enough of Custer. We'll go with our final thoughts. Neil Jordan, let's go with you, Steve.
He's an interesting cat, and I think, you know, like, he's fallen out of the Hollywood spotlight a little bit, and it's kind of a drag, because, you know, I guess it's the hype train of The Crying Game and Interview with the Vampire has left the station, and he's had a few really, you know, less than successful efforts, and, it only takes one or two to really kill your buzz in Hollywood. And it's kind of a shame because some of his later work, man, like Undine was actually a pretty tight little movie. The Brave One, I think, is an excellent flick. It's one of the better, you know, psychological crime thrillers to come along in the last number of years. You know,
Good Thief is amazing.
The Good Thief is absolutely incredible. It's a great movie. And he's, you know, he's got a, I won't say it's a unique visual style, but it's definitely a signature visual style. You know, like he's in that tier of directors who's got, there are only a handful of them, who can really do this deep textured kind of these really like just enthralling visuals, you know, like he really has a way of pulling you in without, you know, again, without being painterly, without, you know, composing a shot for hours and that sort of thing. He has a natural way of really drawing you in with scenery, you know, like really lighting well, texturing well, and just pulling your eye, which is really cool. 'Cause not a lot of directors really do it without being, you know, known as a visual director or, you know, someone like Ridley Scott, who's just, you know, a visual masterpiece painter or something. But Jordan has this way of doing it that, you know, it feels effortless. It doesn't feel pre-planned. It doesn't feel, you know, like it's been pondered or studied too much. Like he's not meticulous over his framing.
Mm.
He has a way of really pulling you in. He's got a photographer's eye.
Well, you have to remember that he was schooled by Borman, basically.
Yeah, and I mean Excalibur, Deliverance.
Yeah,
you know, we got to do a Borman episode.
Yeah, for sure.
You guys have to do a John Borman episode with Stardust.
What about you, Antoine? What's your thoughts on Neil Jordan?
Well, I didn't know Neil Jordan very well when I was invited to do this podcast. I had only seen Interview with the Vampire and Michael Collins and In Dreams. So I got into this pretty much watching his whole filmography with few exceptions that I skipped. And overall, I have to say that I'm not a big fan of him. I really, really like Mona Lisa, but apart from Mona Lisa, I think that he's a very good director visually and technically, but there's just something missing in his movies that would make me care about the characters. In most cases, Michael Collins, I liked what was going on, but I didn't really get into the story as much as I could because I felt the characters were not really relatable to me personally.
It really felt that Michael Collins felt like a very much a product of its time. You know, it felt like one of those early 90s, you know, Hollywood biopic, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It was very, very straightforward and very, didn't spend too much time on the characters, just focused on the action and what was going on. And while that was impressive and very informative in terms of, you know, historical value, you know, it was lacking something to make it like a great movie to me. So, but I really enjoyed, we didn't talk about it much, but well, we didn't talk about it at all, but he still produced and I think created the TV series The Borges, which I watched. I thought that was really amazing.
Well, because we usually focus on movies more, but yeah, I know he did that. It comes no surprise since I picked him that I'm a pretty big Neil Jordan fan. Ever since I saw Interview with a Vampire, I never read the book when I saw it, and I came to totally unprepared and just fell in love with that movie. And then I see out A Company of Wolves, and that really blew me away. I mean,
yeah, that's good. I love that.
For a low budget village, it's so impressive. And I think there's something in his work that just appeals to me generally. The visual stuff we talked about, but he also, I think, as I said, he wrote or co-wrote most of his scripts. And I think he has like this literary novelistic approach to screenwriting for the most part, where even if you don't really get the characters, I mean, they're very well written and often tri-dimensional. They're complex characters for most part. And I mean, there's only a few characters like him who can tackle so many different genres of pictures and succeed at most of them. I mean, he doesn't get comedy at all.
But, no, he really doesn't.
But when there's humor in his pictures, like in The Butcher Boy or even Interview with the Vampire, or like, I keep forgetting the name of this movie, but the Transvestite movie he did with Cillian Murphy.
Breakfast on Pluto.
I mean, that's totally over the top, bright. I mean, it's like the adjective I'm looking for is fabulous. You know, the gay fabulous. That's Breakfast on Pluto. It's a pretty fun and unusual picture, and I think he's got like unusual interests that don't really get discussed much. I mean, unusual sexuality is the running theme through all of his movies. From the unusual family in Interview with the Vampire to the prostitute love story in Mona Lisa to Transvestite to Love Triangle even in Michael Collins.
I just pieced it together, I think. I realized the word I'm searching for. Art house. He is, you know, an art house director kind of hiding under a big budget, you know, Hollywood studio system blanket.
When you look at it, like, I mean, the only big budget things that he's done really are Interview with the Vampire and maybe The Brave One.
Yeah, that's true.
And the rest is mostly indie stuff.
Yeah,
and I think his involvement in making The Crying Game was really, really important in terms of placing Miramax on the map. I think at that time it was still a little company and it was looking for, you know, innovative movie to have a distinct style and to draw the crowd in, and it was one of those movies in that era where everything Miramax put out was really worth watching. I think like that was really it was perfect for that era and that style.
Yeah, he really kind of spearheaded the Miramax as art house studio campaign. I think the Crying Game was kind of one of the first, you know, rounds they fired off in that particular arsenal.
So I guess on that note, we'll say bye. And next week, be sure to tune in next week when we discuss Andrew's choice of Howard Hawks. The whole gang should be back to discuss this classic filmmaker of The Big Sleep and the original Scarface.
Should be an interesting time.
Going back in time a little here to the 1930s and so forth. So thank you, Steve.
No problem.
And thank you, Antoine, for stepping in.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a lot of fun.
And see you next Wednesday.